Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. This is the second part and concluding part of my report from the Karlo Vivari Film Festival in the Czech Republic. It was a wonderful festival, I enjoyed it immensely, and the company was superb, as you will hear. I talked to a variety of writers to get their takes on the films and also on the festival experience generally. I'm kicking off with Damon Wise. He's a great writer. He's written for Empire and a lot of different places, The Guardian, The Guide, a lot of different places, and he's currently writing for Deadline.
So let's talk about When the Ice Melts. This is a Belgian film that originally showed at Sundance, I think.
Well, we're podcasting now.
We've been podcasting all along.
I know.
You don't know what I'm going to leave in, what I'm going to take out.
It's like the end of The Shining. It's going to turn out I've been podcasting all the way through this festival.
You've always been the podcaster.
I am. I am podcast. So what do you want me to talk about?
When the Ice Melts, the Belgian film.
Well, in the Ice Melts, I had seen a little bit before of that movie because they had a thing in Antwerp called Belgium Connects, and so I didn't. Yeah, it was. I knew vaguely what it was about. I knew it was based on a book, and I knew that it was based on two timelines about a young girl going back to her village to confront a dark secret from her past. But even so, I wasn't quite prepared for how dark it was going to get. Now, bear in mind, I didn't see it. I saw it on my computer late at night, so it probably had a very small effect on me, but. It certainly is one of the most powerful endings I've seen in a long time. It's up there, I think, with even Haneke, actually, in terms of a shocking exploration of teenage sexuality, and also how much people are prepared to forget when their families are involved. I think that to me is the most impressive part of the film, about how it can construct this atmosphere of oppressive collusion. this girl goes back to home to hometown to accuse her childhood friends of abuse, basically, and then she's proven horribly right, and you see kind of it's more about the kind of, it's not really about the events as such, but the conspiracy of silence that has coalesced over the years to cover it all up. And I was quite shaken by that film, actually, for quite some time. I don't think I went to bed until the early hours of the morning.
Yeah, there was a silence when the film finished at the screening last night. I watched it at 10 o'clock at the festival in the beautiful theatre, the City Theatre, absolutely gorgeous setting, but a very, very bleak film. And yet, sort of like, it is beautifully filmed as well. There is the flashback sequences take place in a summery village, which is quite idyllic, and the present day is kind of a wintry Brussels for the most part, and then back to the village. But it's a cold, obviously a colder, but it's really thoughtfully filmed as well, with lots of the shots paralleled between the two timelines.
But if you didn't know about the if it wasn't for the contemporary timeline, it would be quite a jolly film about childhood, I think, because they talk about each other, the Three Musketeers, and the sort of the, it's a bit like the, almost like the Goonies in the way that it kind of portrays this kind of, and then when they start asking, when her childhood friends start asking kids to take their clothes off, or young girls take their clothes off, that's when you realise it's going in an entirely different direction.
Yeah, and even that could be contained in a sort of American Pie style of boys will be boys, yeah, kind of way, although this film obviously sees it almost from the get-go as an insidious and toxic way of behaving. There's a sort of brilliant image where they have the swimming pool over the cesspit.
Where the boy died,
and it's just like, we're referring to The Shining before we started recording. But yeah, you're building the house on the Indian ancestral graveyard.
Yeah.
Have you seen any other good films at the festival?
No.
I'll
have to think about that. I need to think about that before I say any more, to be honest. I need to think about that.
Hey, man.
Hello.
I'm looking for you.
I'm here.
Have your ticket.
Excellent. I thought you'd probably...
Now I'm going to talk to Ben Dalton, who writes for Screen, but he predominantly writes news pieces for Screen, and he asked me to make it clear that these opinions that he is stating in this interview are purely on a personal basis and are not representative of the opinions of his publication.
Okay,
Ben Dalton.
Oh dear.
I'm collecting tape for my for the podcast. Okay. So what's the name of the film again, Ben?
The Czech title is Bod Above Knee. In English, it's Restore Point.
Okay. And so what were you just saying before I turned on the recorder?
It's a very professionally done film, perhaps slightly more than you might expect for a debut feature for a lot of the key collaborators. First feature for the director, producer, cinematographer, first lead role for the lead actress. And it is already set for release in Czech cinemas, but feels like it could manage to get some international play as well. It's very influenced by directors who've worked in Hollywood on such films, the name like Christopher Nolan, Denis Villeneuve. It's got that kind of feel to it. Obviously it's a lower budget, but very technically adept and engaging.
What's the high concept? Because I think that's the particular sort of selling point of the film.
Sure, so it's set in 2041, so a kind of near future. At a time when social unrest and violence has really peaked and has reached, a horrible point, and citizens can sign up to a technology that allows, if they are murdered, allows them to be restored, almost like in a video game, to a point, I think it's within 48 hours of their death. But in the film, this technology is at risk of being taken over by private corporations who may not have it in the best interest of the people. And that's the concept through which this police detective has to investigate a couple who have been murdered beyond that realm, so it seems that they're not going to be able to be restored.
It has a sort of Rick and Morty feel to it. Does it manage to escape that? Or Black Mirror, maybe?
I wouldn't say sort of po-faced, but in the way of Christopher Nolan, it's not comic. It's not played for laughs. It's serious. But it manages that tone well. It treads that line of a serious sci-fi. It's kind of well played. I guess you'd see the sort of budget difference from Hollywood things in that there aren't grand set pieces particularly. It all looks very, very good. It's great cinematography and I think some, adept VFX, but there's not grand explosions, big car chases or anything like that. So that's probably where the budget difference is coming in. But it's very engaging. It's a good watch. It's a touch over 2 hours, so it doesn't overstay its welcome, but it's a good watch.
Brilliant. And you're a veteran of Carlo Vivari, so while I've got you talking into my phone, what do you think of this edition, and what do you think of this festival generally?
I think it's a wonderful festival for the Central European region, and it's a great event for the Czech Republic as a country. They get dignitaries from all across their society to come here. I think it's increasing in importance from my 4 years here for the film industry. I think there's a lot of talk about, all films would love to go to Cannes, would love to go to Venice, would love to go to Toronto, but that's just numerically not possible. I think Carlo Vivari is a great place, particularly for debut feature filmmakers, second-time filmmakers, to launch a film, because you've got a very cine-literate and excited, passionate audience. Getting that interest and that boost on a film can be as good as you can get lost on the Quasette with the number of films, and that's less likely here. You're a bigger fish in a slightly smaller pond, and that really allows some talent to shine through. So this year, for example, Nakash Khalid's UK debut was in camera, is getting some really good reports, and it feels like this can be a good launch pad for a film of that size and that scale to go on to other festivals and go on to sort of wider distribution.
Yeah, which would otherwise sort of be hidden away in a sidebar and might not break out. And last question, have you drank any of the water from the fountains? There are 14 fountains in town?
It's a big selling point is their local water for various uses. It's great in the spas. For drinking, I would say not so much.
It's sort of rotten eggy, isn't it?
It has a particular taste that, a sip to try it is fine. You wouldn't want a pint. But in the spas, when you're soaking in one of the baths, it's lovely. So clearly, has its uses.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Ben.
No trouble.
There you go.
Oh, that's great.
Pleasure to talk to the artistic director of the film festival, Carol Ock.
I'm kicking myself. I missed Master and Commander because
it was 35mm.
Oh god damn it!
Oh no, you made me worse. Feel worse.
That's one of my favourite films. My top 10 sight and sound favourite films.
Yeah?
That's in.
Wow.
There.
No, I insisted this one. I picked on purpose, not just because it's the anniversary, but also I think it's underseen and it should be praise more, because I think it's a masterpiece, and I rewatched it after 20 years now, and I saw different things in it, which is so. I mean, it's such a romantic film.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's no woman, and it's a romance. I don't say you necessarily need a woman to have a romance, but it feels like it doesn't matter, what gender it is. It's just a strongly romantic film. And
oh, absolutely! It's absolutely beautiful. A beautiful film about friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to know, this being my first time, I've heard a lot about the festival from other people. What's sort of the history of the festival? What's the sort of, what's the origin story?
Carlo International Film Festival is an old young festival, I would say, because we were born 1946.
Right.
Same year as Cannes and Locarno. Obviously, as of 1948, when the communists took power in the Czechoslovakia, you could not really talk about the freedom of speech and the choices, you know, the programming choices. But it did have some exclusive discoveries, especially in the so-called Third World. There was a strong presence of African cinema, and our predecessor discovered some African filmmakers who then later went on for a big careers like in Cannes, etc. But in the early 90s, when the communism fell down, there was a necessity to, you know, be reborn, to find a new shape, new identity, and a famous Czech actor Jiří Bartoška has become the face, not just the face of the festival, but its president and the owner of the company organizing it. He's still president of the festival. And next to him, it was Mrs. Zauralova, who was a famous film critic who was about to retire, but he called her to become the artist director. And she learned everything from scratch, how to invite films, how to create what we try to continue now. And she picked me as her successor in 2010. Unfortunately, she passed away last year, but she's here with us. And then, as I said, whatever they achieved in the 90s, and I'm talking hundreds of backpackers sleeping everywhere, it was like a Woodstock kind of thing. So we took it further in terms of the reputation in the world, and maybe more daring choices in the program, a more complex program, the industrial section, but that's the heritage we work with. There's a really interesting element to this year's festival, which kind of answers your question as well. In 1948, there was a young Slovak guy, Eduard Grečner. He was 17. He came to the festival, which was the third year, and he watched a Mexican film, Puerto Escondido, and he decided he was going to be a filmmaker. He made it quite big in the 60s. He did some significant films. Then he strongly opposed the invasion of the Soviet troops in Czechoslovakia, and he was cancelled, basically. He could no longer work. Later on in the 90s, he tried to resume his career, etc. He's still alive. He's 91 years old, and there's a documentary about him, on him, that we're premiering, and he's coming back. So we have a comeback after 75 years to the festival.
Right, you're like, which kind of the beginning and the end.
Yeah, so there's nothing that stops us in connecting or trying to connect present and past, which is what we try to do in guest department, but also in the programming.
And it's an amazing setting as well, the town itself.
The location is a key. I mean, right. We often discuss this with our friends and colleagues from other festivals, how incredibly hard it is to organize a festival in a big city where most of the people live and work, because they come careless here. They leave the kids with the grandparents, they lock the apartment, and they go to a summer camp, and we can invade their space with heavy, hardcore art house cinema, and they're ready. They're open, they're, they don't have to think about the morning after, etc. And this is very beautiful, and it creates the atmosphere. So Genius Loci of this crazy cake type of thing and the valley, it helps a lot.
And the audiences have been incredibly impressive. I mean, I've been to lots and lots of film festivals, but this is probably one of the first where almost every screening is full or very nearly full.
It is. And, well, historically, the dates that were picked were always the beginning of the summer holidays. So it is kind of in the notion or in the mental space of every youngster who's interested in a film to go to Galloway and to start the summer with it, right? So you end the school and you come here, and my older son, he's 15 now, and he's watched 5-6 movies. And because his vacations are starting now, obviously, people take vacations. And I've been working here for 23 years, and I've seen the audience also changing, because at the beginning they were rather modest in terms of the questions to the directors, and now they're really like outspoken and challenging the filmmakers with questions, which has got to do with the changes in society and the transformation of a post communist country into something different. The audience is our most valuable asset.
Yeah, and I mean, I was at a Q&A for a documentary on Richard Harris, and one of the audience members asked a very astute question of, but as you say, sort of not in any way sort of passive or adoring. It was like, I'm not sure if you really got this. And it was great for the filmmakers, I think, to have that response immediately.
It seems they enjoy it.
Yeah. What was your? I mean, you have some great guests here in this edition. I know you've had in the past. What has been a particular? I know you don't want to be undiplomatic, but what has been a particularly exciting get over the years?
Well, I'd like to mention Benicio del Toro as an actor who not only I've desired to bring to Cagliari, or I've decided that we bring him here. But also just this, you know, there's charisma around, which surrounds the actors who are the soul of movies. And that charisma you want to bring here. And Benicio is one of the most charismatic actors. And what surprised us and what made me mention his name as first was that when he came here, we realized he was a great connoisseur of the Czechoslovak cinema. Not only he knew, you know, Forman, Chytilová, Menzel, all the big films, but he knew films that I don't think even many Czech know, and he knew some particular trivia about it. I mean, he brought two pages of titles that he wanted to get the Blu-rays of and bring back, and he bought some posters. I mean, a true cinephile and a very kind person. Jeffrey Rush was with him last year, very sweet person. Ewan McGregor this year, even though he came only for 24 hours, incredibly sweet and funny guy. Alicia Vikander came accompanied by Michael Fassbender, who was not announced. He was just plus one. Which is...
Did somebody stop him at the door? She had to say, oh, no, he's with me.
He's with me. He's you know, he's the babysitter.
Yeah.
Because they have a child with them as well. No, it's... Somehow it might be difficult to get certain people because we do not pay any fees. We want them to come and promote the movies, so, like Alicia did with Firebrand. But once they get here, they become fans of the festival, which kind of manifests in the trailers, the little films we screen before the movies, because we ask the awardees to star in them after the festival, when they wouldn't really have to do anything right for us, because they're done with Calaway. Yet 6 months later, 1 year later, with Johnny Depp, 2 years later, we find time in their schedule, we fly over there, and there's a crew and filmmaker, and in one half day we shoot the trailer, which then becomes you know, an element of the festival which no other festival has. We shared the world premiere of the trailer of Johnny Depp through his social media, and we have like 3,600,000 views in 2 days. It's mad. And this all thanks to the kindness of our guests, to go back to your question.
Sure. And I mean, bringing up Johnny Depp, I've just come back from Taormina, and I was with Amber Heard and Taormina.
Oh, wow.
I know, so
really?
I'm doing the
How
set.
About
that? I mean, what was the... There must have been some conversation in terms of, you know, he's obviously coming with some baggage.
Baggage is something that we try to not to contribute to, because the baggage... There's all kinds of baggages, right? There's baggage of Harvey Weinstein type of people, convicted. And there is something which we could not be happier that it's changing, and that this Pandora's box has opened up, and the environment is being cleaned up, if I say it a little radically, from all this really, really disgusting stuff.
Yeah.
Then there is other baggage, which is what people write about someone who is going through a trial and has to kind of stand a lot of bad writings. But if we want to honor the presumption of innocence, we must never, you know, make conclusions. And that baggage becomes slightly irrelevant, especially when the judgment is innocent. So that's something that I think we need to talk about nuances always, because it's easy to frame someone, to put a stain on someone, and it's difficult to clean the stain afterwards. And I mean, can I say Johnny Depp starred in the opening movie of Cannes Film Festival this year, and by the way, a great performance. And so that type of baggage we consider to dismiss.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I have two here's two girls from Romania. So last question.
Okay. Okay, so because this is a Writers on Film podcast, and I noticed you have the Quentin Tarantino book on your shelf there.
Yeah, this is a brand new Czech translation.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you if you have a sort of favourite film book, a book that sort of has given you insights into cinema or fueled your passion from long ago, or something you go back to, or even something you've just discovered.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, this book is incredible. Cinema Speculation, that's something that is a dream come true for any cinephile, to read a book written by someone whose film you admire and respect, but who is also a cinephile, who knows how to write about films, who knows how to challenge certain notions about the films, and he is not afraid, because he has a certain reputation, to kind of maybe undermine certain stereotypes. And it's exciting. I loved throughout the years many books that I read because of the retrospectives. We did mostly the autobiographies. I enjoyed very much Sam Fuller book, Michael Powell's book, the Kevin MacDonald's book on his grandfather, Emeric Pressburger. I mean, all these beautiful books, John Huston, Elio Petri. I mean, always in the autumn we decide what the retrospective will be, and then I start watching the films and reading the books, and it's like being back in school without the stress of the exam. It's just enjoying to be surrounded by this beauty and this richness of the film history, and well, that's why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, well, you'll love my my podcast. You should listen to it, Writers on Film.
Okay.
We go through all the books and, interview the authors.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that we could have another conversation about the books when I would start remembering.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Real pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure from both mine.
Ben Nicholson is a writer with The Verdict, as his work has appeared in many magazines, including Sight and Sound and Cineview. And he's talking about a new film by a British director, a debut feature film called In Camera. So this is our conversation.
What are you writing for, by the way, Ben?
Film Verdict.
Oh, of course, yeah, as you mentioned that the other day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm going to do a Cineview roundup.
Right.
Which is the bit that I like doing, because it means I can just go and see what I want and then write a little thing about it. The Film Verdict's the bit where I'm constantly writing, going and seeing, you know, I've got
deadlines.
6-7 reviews to do throughout the festival.
Oh, wow, great stuff.
So it's great, but it's such a different experience for a festival to what I was doing 2 years ago. You know, when I came to Vary in 2020, well, before the pandemic, I guess now, like, I would have come and done my Cineview piece. So I'd have come, spent 5 days watching whatever I wanted, maybe pitch something to Sight and Sound if I saw something that was UK and thought it was, you know. But otherwise, I get on the plane and I write up my favourite seven films in a, you know, 100 words each for Cineview, and I send it off, and Vary love it, and it's great. You know, so it was working perfectly well. And then...
And then
I had to go and ruin it. I started to work for a trade. And it's a very different... I spend more time in my hotel room than I used to.
That's a weird thing. Yeah, me too. I'm doing a lot of writing in hotel rooms.
I just kind of... And I get, like, sent links to stuff if we can't see things. And I'm like... I wrote Rotterdam. There was one day where I was like, I don't think I'm going to see anything in the cinema today.
Yeah.
And I've come to Rotterdam to the film festival, and I'm doing something that I effectively could be doing in my bedroom. Like, I could be in the study at home and not be here to do this. And like,
yeah.
But you know, it's the nature of it. But it's a different. It's a very different festival vibe.
I find that sort of writing for the trades. I really enjoy when it's a festival that isn't particularly. And then, for instance, I don't think I'd like to write for a trade for Cannes.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I
yeah.
really want to go and see the movies.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't want to be yeah. deadlining and
pick the one movie and then that's your day. You yeah. know, like the which potentially it's not quite that bad, but it can be. Like yeah. you know, I can be like, right, well, I've seen the thing. Now, although there are three more things on, I really need to go back to the hotel and write that thing up so that you know.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that we're not. It's not quite so. It's not quite so dogmatic as that, in that they're, you know, we've got a quota of reviews and the three of us here, and it's write about things that are interesting or that you like. It's not cover this, even if you hate it, you know, and you've got to go back to the hotel and write 700 words about something you don't have anything to say about. You can always just drop it.
Yeah.
So it's good in that respect, but it's just a very different, you know, vibe. You know, I've written, I don't know, 10,000 words by the time I leave, and I'm like, that's a chapter of a book, and that's for 5 days. That's quite a lot. So it just feels a bit like, yeah, it can end up by the end feel a bit like a slog.
Yeah, where like actual work.
Like, yeah, today I've got two tickets this evening for the Masamura film, two Masamura films,
right, which is so, a retrospective yeah, you've been following.
Yeah, but it's that's all I'm seeing today. Otherwise, I'm writing.
Right.
So,
right. I don't think I'm seeing a single film today. I've got
interviews.
That's
the way of it, right?
I've got interviews, I've got writing. And that's
yeah.
it, the whole day.
Yeah.
What has been your highlight of the festival?
My highlight so far, In Camera.
Okay, tell us about that. This is a British debut film?
Yes, Nikash Khalid's debut feature. As the short film writer for the Film Verdict, I'm always have to be very careful with those words because I'm like, it's not their debut. I write about short films. It's his debut feature.
Yeah.
And it is a story about a... Well, story is probably mis-selling it. It's a film about an actor played by Naban Rizwan. And he is, I guess, searching for a role, is I think how the synopsis puts it. And it's really a very fragmented portrait of his life as an aspiring actor, not getting roles, going to auditions, doing workshops, trying to find something to kind of pin himself on. But it's just a really fascinating kind of piece about identity and about the lack thereof in someone who wants to spend their life reading other people's words, you know, and this kind of, it's a very strange film with a very strange ambience. And he kind of finds roles to play in different aspects of his life that aren't necessarily his jobs. There are other kind of roles that he begins to take on in this kind of very strange situation. I don't want to try to explain the narrative because there really isn't one.
Right.
But it's just incredible. It's just genuinely the Proxima competition at Colo Vivari was started last year and replaced their East of West, and it was intended to be bold new visions with experimental edges. And last year I felt that the Proxima competition was a little bit all over the place.
Right.
There were a couple of films that sort of fit that brief. There are other films where I was just like, I don't, I mean, There's not really anything experimental in this film. It's got a weird vibe, but it's not really anything particularly formally interesting about it. And I saw this and was like, oh, this is what they were talking about.
This is
like,
a signature.
I hope that this is what the rest of the program is, because this is what they were talking about when they said they used all of those buzzy words last year. They were talking about something like In Camera, and it's great because it's, you know, like the director and all three of the lead actors have all been like screen stars of tomorrow. So it's a very kind of it's a interesting piece that's full of loads of buzzy names. Amir Al-Masri's in it in a smaller role, who everyone you know is in love with after Limbo and stuff. So. And he's just fantastic in a kind of supporting role in this. I'm going to be interested to see how it has a life beyond Vary, because it's full of buzzy names, particularly for the UK. But it's quite a difficult film. It's quite a nebulous film that I feel like if it didn't have buzzy names in it, it wouldn't really get much coverage. By people in the press, I mean. So it'd be interesting to see how the critics and things respond to it when it starts moving around places, or whether it gets much response from here. Like I know the guy at Variety's written a positive review of it. So Guy Lodge at Variety. Guy Lodge at Variety has written a positive review of it. So I think, you know, this currently the reviews are all. The reviews that have come in are all good.
Helena Lazic as well.
Oh, she written about it. I didn't. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's IndieWire or some.
Yeah, she's here for IndieWire, I think, right. Isn't she? Yeah. So probably. So yeah. So this. So you know, it's good that it started like that, and it will be interesting to see. Yeah, if it kind of captures people in the way that I would hope it would.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. In looking forward to some new sort of British filmmakers, you know. Tom Hardiman's Medusa Deluxe has just come out in the UK, and I saw that last year at Locarno.
Yeah.
And there we saw the wonderful How to Have Sex at Cannes. Director's name escapes me. You've got it because you're good at names.
No, I've not got it.
Oh god, damn it!
Sorry.
That's okay. This is where during the edit I will put myself very confidently saying the name of the director.
Sure.
Note to editor John. Do that.
Yeah.
So it's really good to have these new voices coming up. My one criticism of In Camera, and I think it goes to what you said about the narrative. Is that it was interesting that you mentioned about being the short features, being responsible for short films in the verdict, is that it felt very much like three short films that had been put together.
Mm-hmm.
That had that sort of. I thought there was several stories in here which could have each been a short film.
Sure.
But I'm not sure that's necessarily a negative criticism, because, as you say, the nebulous nature of the film kind of allows for that to happen.
Yeah, I think, I think maybe Guy Lodge in his review mentioned about the kind of, there's a strange sort of asides with one of the side characters, Rory, played by Rory Fleckburn, Bo, his flatmate, who has these kind of very surreal encounters, or they're not even really encounters. He just has these very surreal scenes on his own where he has a problem with a vending machine, and then he's driving through the country and he sees this vending machine, and then he has several kind of weird dreams and things. And I think Guy mentioned kind of that feeling like it's a separate thing from a separate film. It's interesting because I have some theories about In Camera.
Me too, yeah.
And so I'm not sure I do feel like that any of those things aren't separate. I think they all feed into the same story that I have, that I took away from In Camera.
Right.
I think, and the idea that, you know, Nakash took, I think when he pitched it, he talked about it as like being like a concept album. And it was kind of about like different tracks that you listen to in a whole, but they have their own kind of vibe,
it's
and they come together.
Side of the moon.
I guess so. And I think what I find quite interesting is the fragmentary nature of the narrative. While the directors talked about it as being like the fragmentary nature of real life, like the messiness of life, I think it's also interesting that there's a character in there who has a very fragmented idea of identity.
And so the idea, the identity of that main character is also very fragmentary. And so these different stories that we see, or even they're almost different like modes, you know, there are, there's like the satire of his auditions is a very, very different vibe to the work he does as an actor in these like much more in-depth workshops, which are very serious drama. And then he's also, he's a very vacant character, a very impassive character a lot of the time, although I think that the performance is good enough that he never seems impassive, although he's very quiet and drawn. So I don't know, I kind of feel like they all feed into things that maybe I think about the film that aren't necessarily there on the page and aren't necessarily what the filmmaker intended, but they're kind of ideas that I've taken away from it.
Yeah, I agree with you, actually. I think that the sort of gluons of narrative could have just been a little bit more explicit to make that to communicate that more to the audience. Yeah. But then again, you know, that means making it into a different film, and I'm not sure that's our job as critics to sort of suggest that.
Exactly. And I mean, I spoke to Nakash about that when I asked him, did he feel pressure from the outside or from himself to make the film less difficult?
Yeah.
And he basically said, I treated this film as if I was never going to make a film again. So I made the film I wanted to make, and he was like, you know, I didn't not take on board criticism or not take on board other people's ideas, but I was very, very sure that I knew the film I wanted to make. I'm not interested in normal narrative films, and what if I never get to do this again? This might be my one chance to do this. I don't want to make something that I'm going to look back on and not be proud of. Which is, you know, which is an interesting thing, because yeah, I agree. It's interesting when critics, and we do this with everything, and I'm guilty of doing it as well. Like, but we review the film we wish something was. You know, when I went and saw Man of Steel, I wrote a 1,500-word review of the Superman film I wish I'd seen, not the, to my mind, awful film that I did see. But, you know, like, I was aware when I finished it, I was like, this isn't a review of that film. This is me saying, you got it wrong. You got the whole basis of this wrong. And here's why this doesn't marry up to my idea of this character you created. And actually, you know, although, you know, fans can be really vehement in doing that with things that have existing fan bases, such as superhero films, I think we do it as critics anyway. You know, we say, like, but this film about relationships isn't what I think relationships are, and thus I think this film's got it wrong. And that's an interesting thing to navigate, obviously, as a critic. So I think people have to, you know, I certainly sometimes read reviews of people and think, oh, are you angry at this film, or are you angry that this is not a film that is not a film that you wanted this film to be? You know, and by the same vein, if In Camera had started out really fragmentary and then become more conventionally narrative, I probably would have liked it less, because I wanted it to be more experimental. You know, I was enjoying the experimental, and I write about the more avant-garde films, and so I would have maybe had a very different reaction to someone who may have viewed it more positively, because they'd have said, oh, and it coalesces all of these things together at the end into a satisfying conclusion. And I would have been like, and it cops out at the end by bringing it all together into a satisfying conclusion. You know, we talked about another film, Red Rooms, the other day, where we talked about the ending and whether or not that ending, what that ending means, you know, and people will have very different reactions to that, and it will make the film better or worse as a result in their minds, you know, which is it's the fun thing about reading other critics always, you know, and the fun thing about talking about films, but it's a dangerous game.
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Red Rooms is I remember now, it's actually the film that we were going to talk about initially, because that's the one we. But that's great. I'll just briefly give a sort of synopsis for the audience. Red Rooms is a Canadian thriller, and it's about a woman who is a sort of high-end model, and she also seems to make a living with some sort of trading and some professional poker, and she's obsessed with a trial of a serial killer who is connected to the internet, because he was also running a series of Red Rooms in which he would broadcast videos of his tortures and murders of young women. It is a really stylistic thriller. It reminded me a little bit of Michael Mann, but it's even more overtly theatrical and stylistic than that. And yet, it really does something with a genre where I thought I'd kind of seen everything. And I was a little bit going in, I was a little bit cautious. I wasn't particularly looking forward to seeing it. And it was just riveting from beginning to end. What was your take of it?
Yeah, I mean, I find it really gripping. And it has a very distinct mood, which is kind of withdrawn and icy and calculating, and I think is intended to reflect to some degree its main character. But at the same time, it's never kind of cold in the sense that we feel disconnected. You're absolutely invested in what's happening, maybe just not necessarily invested in the character herself.
Yeah.
But you're invested in the strangeness of this situation, particularly, you know, this idea of her and this other young woman that she meets who are effectively fangirls of this person who's on trial. It's a really compulsive film that is maybe, it's a bit like watching a car crash. Not in the sense that you can't take your eyes away from something awful, but just that you're aware of how repulsive, effectively, this character, what's implied about these characters is, and yet they're all very hard to look at. They're magnetic, which is a fascinating thing to do with a film, and it's why I think potentially a lot of people will find it troubling for that reason. But I think that's intended. And that, I think that's, you know, you kind of have a knot in your stomach through a lot of it because you just can't quite believe what you're seeing and that someone can behave in the way they are. There's a scene where the central character hacks into someone's emails, the mother of one of the victims, so quickly and knowledgeably that I really felt my stomach fall out at that moment, because it was such a horrific, you know, she basically used like "Have I Been Pawned" website,
yeah,
to see if someone's passwords had been leaked, and then used the dark web to find the data leak that had the person's passwords in, and then goes into the email, and in the email finds an email with the reset code for the alarm on the person's house, you know, and she does all this in like 60 seconds, and you're watching the screens as she's doing it, and it was. You're kind of glimpsing behind the curtain here of someone that's very difficult to empathise with, and for most audience members is the furthest thing from what they are, and yet it's gripping, and you can't quite look, because you kind of want to know what's driving her, what's next, and then the ending means that none of those questions are ever really answered, because the ending is so ambiguous. That it, or makes ambiguous everything you've seen before it.
And you've got this also thing that she's a model by profession, so she's this magnetically beautiful woman,
yeah,
as well. So the halo effect means that we are likely to ascribe positive attributes to someone who's beautiful.
Sure.
But also there's that slightly misogynistic, very misogynistic thing of whenever a man murders and tortures women, we look for the nearest woman to blame.
Mm-hmm.
And to put our guilt on it, in terms of, you know, Peter Sutcliffe's wife, for instance, got huge amounts of blame of sort of like, how could she not have known? Well, mm-hmm. She wasn't the one going out and killing women with hammers, you know, but she seemed to get a disproportionate amount of blame, as if she was almost equal to Peter in terms of what he'd been doing. Fascinating, thoughtful film. I'm looking forward to speaking to the director later and getting into his head about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, Ben. It's been great talking to you.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
That's super duper. Lemon scooper. So you don't like Pink Floyd, I noticed by your wincing.
No, it's more just that it's
you're a yes man.
It's the go-to concept album.
I
didn't want to say like yes, but I mean, there's a lot more of them. I was like, is it? I didn't want to say it is.
But I thought Darker Side of the Moon, because of the lunacy aspect.
Yeah, that's
it wasn't
fair, that's
ran.
Fair. No, but it's that's what it wasn't. It wasn't a Pink Floyd thing. It was a. Is it Dark Side of the Moon? and is that just an easy concept? And I was like, I don't have time to have that conversation now on this. So that's why I paused. That was my pause. Was to right. go, was I wanted to go like, I don't know, is it A Dark Side of the Moon? Do I need to
find Marillion? What's
is, it, yeah, is there a different album, a different concept album? Not I think it is more like. But yeah, I'm not entirely convinced.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.